autonomous systems tend to be smaller. They're not exclusively smaller, but one of the reasons that we have such large tractors and harvesters nowadays is that we try to maximize the efficiency of the person driving the machine to make that person get as much done as they possibly can. If we go to a fully autonomous system, then we can take that person off the machine, and then the machine doesn't need to be so big. We could potentially replace one large machine with, say, five smaller machines. And if we replace it with five smaller machines, then we can get some advantages in precision, for example. You know, if we maybe we don't want to spray a 120-foot swath at one time, maybe we can spray a 20-foot swath at one time or something like that and be much more precise in our applications, much more precise in everything we do. And we can also, with lighter machines, reduce the effect of soil compaction and that kind of thing.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. A robust return on your sorghum investment is not just a dream. Learn more at doubleteamsorghum.com. KWS Hybrid Rye, seeding the future since 1856.
Welcome to the Crop Science podcast show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, assistant professor in integrative precision ag at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Alex Thomason. He is the department head of the Department of Agricultural and Biological Engineering and the director of the Agricultural Autonomy Institute, both at Mississippi State University. Alex, welcome to the Crop Science podcast show. It's really great to have you here today. And to get us started, could you share with us about your path, your background, and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Thank you, Leo. Appreciate the opportunity. Grew up in Texas, in the Houston, Texas area. Was not growing up on a farm, so my introduction to agriculture was a little bit visiting family members who were involved in farming when I was growing up. And about right before my senior year in high school, a cousin asked me to come work on his farm. And it was, I think, the first day I was there, I remember crawling under a tractor with a grease gun about 6 a.m. and seeing the sun come up. And I thought, I want to do something related to agriculture. So I got bitten by the bug. And up to that point, you know, I was thinking about going to college, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And all of a sudden I thought, I really want to do something in agriculture and I like machinery. And so I was planning to go to Texas Tech University, which is where I went. And I originally intended to go into what was at that time called agricultural mechanization. And I got there and I spoke to the department head and he looked at my test scores and said, you know, you're pretty good in math. You really ought to think about going into agricultural engineering. And I said, yes, sir, roger that. And that's what I did and loved it. And then I went directly from there into graduate school, also in agricultural engineering, went to Louisiana State University. And ultimately, I went to University of Kentucky for a PhD in agricultural engineering. And as I was going through that, I was kind of moving somewhat from machinery more into electronics and optical sensing technologies and things like that. And that's had become my expertise, although in the last few years, I've really been more focused on autonomous systems like drones and robots and self-driving tractors and that kind of thing.
Perfect. That's a really, really interesting trajectory. And as for especially moving to different parts of the U.S. and different university systems, it's a very, very interesting, you know, background to get to where you are today. So you mentioned that you've been recently working more with robots and autonomous systems. And so for those in our audience that perhaps are not as familiar with that, what does it mean to be autonomous? Like what characterizes an autonomous system and differentiates it from something that is not autonomous?
A great question. I usually think of autonomous systems as being systems of typically machines or call it mechatronic systems that operate independent of any human involvement. So, for example, if you think of an autonomous tractor, it would be one that could drive itself, turn at the end of the row, potentially stop if it detected an obstacle and that kind of thing.
I see. So it would. Does that mean that it has to be like a ground type of equipment, or does it also apply to something that could be perhaps a drone or something else that is not necessarily on the ground?
typically I draw the circle to include drones. So I think of it as aerial systems and ground-based or terrestrial systems, and even teams of those systems. So there could be cases where you've got multiple drones working together, or a drone working with a robot on the ground, or some combination thereof.
All right. So, you know, that having that concept in mind, I would imagine that certain crops or maybe cropping systems perhaps require more of that type of system, or even are more ready for the uptake of these technologies at this point. Could you comment on that as far as what do you see as being the crops or cropping systems that are going to be the first, you know, uptakes of this type of technology?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty deep question, but I'll do my best to address it. I think what's really driving the move towards autonomous systems in agriculture primarily, although not exclusively, is the difficulty in finding labor on farm. You know, it's pretty common in the U.S. in particular that people have moved away from rural areas into the cities, and as standards of living, even around the world, have increased, people are less and less desirous of going and working at difficult farm jobs, right? I mean, we think of autonomous systems as replacing tasks that are dull, dirty, dangerous, or difficult, like having to stoop and bend and lift things. And so this is really the principal driver, although there are some other things that are driving the move to autonomous systems. And one is that autonomous systems tend to be smaller. They're not exclusively smaller, but one of the reasons that we have such large tractors and harvesters nowadays is that we try to maximize the efficiency of the person driving the machine to make that person get as much done as they possibly can. If we go to a fully autonomous system, then we can take that person off the machine, and then the machine doesn't need to be so big. We could potentially replace one large machine with, say, five smaller machines. And if we replace it with five smaller machines, then we can get some advantages in precision, for example. You know, if we maybe we don't want to spray a 120-foot swath at one time, maybe we can spray a 20-foot swath at one time or something like that and be much more precise in our applications, much more precise in everything we do. And we can also, with lighter machines, reduce the effect of soil compaction and that kind of thing. So to more directly answer your question, in the early stages, I think autonomous systems are being developed sort of in two camps. And one is by the original equipment manufacturer camp, the Cases and John Deere's and Kubota's of the world, who are developing large systems for row cropping. And they are kind of moving towards autonomous systems by building components of, let's call it, the technology stack. So, for example, you think of automatic guidance on a tractor, GPS-based automatic guidance. That's been around for, you know, 15 or 20 years, right? It's very common now. But that is a component of autonomous systems. When these tractors, essentially, you can take your hands off the steering wheel and the tractor can drive itself. So that's a component. So you have to think about what are the follow-on steps that we have to achieve or have to develop for the user to be able to completely exit the machine. And some of those may be obstacle detection or obstacle avoidance and various other things that have to occur. So that's one track of movement towards autonomous systems. And I would say the other track is much more specialty crop oriented. And you have a lot of small companies. For example, there's a conference that started in France. It's called FIRA, F-I-R-A. And there is a U.S. version of that called FIRA USA that happens every fall in California. And I've been to it a couple of times. Lots of different companies developing small autonomous systems for things like strawberry harvesting or even just carts to carry crates of strawberries from the farm worker to the edge of the field where they can be placed on a wagon to remove that sort of walking and carrying aspect of that harvesting process. Those companies tend to be startups. They tend to be less familiar with the whole agricultural equipment world and all of the standards associated with that world. So it's really an interesting mix right now that we have those two tracks operating in this space.
Fantastic. That was a really great explanation as far as those two tracks. I think it was really great that you lined that up. I, because I, you know, I though I guess I don't think enough about autonomous vehicles in agriculture to have realized that pattern. And it is really, really an interesting one to understand the overall landscape. Awesome. So, you know, so you mentioned about attending this conference and really seeing what is coming out on the market, both from larger companies that already have a presence in agriculture, but also from a lot of different startups as well in this space. So, from those experiences and also from your research and what you're seeing growers do, what types of autonomous vehicles are already coming into the market? What do they do? And just an overall idea of like what are they and how ready are they to be really becoming to the market at this stage?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And to some extent, it follows those two tracks I mentioned a moment ago. You do have John Deere, for example, has introduced its autonomous 8R tractor, which is a very large tractor, and it can operate in some tasks autonomously. And again, I was mentioning the fact that these companies are commonly trying to develop parts of that technology stack. And so sometimes they're taking on one specific application, such as tillage. You know, tillage, if you're on a large field in the Midwest, for example, maybe it's fairly flat, it's fairly uniform and rectangular, and there's not really a lot for a driver of the tractor to do. So it's a fairly simple operation, and you can develop an autonomous system for a tractor to do that kind of thing. And that's the first step towards moving towards autonomy with these big vehicles. That's actually coming onto the market now. There is another company that I think is really interesting called Sabanto, S-A-B-A-N-T-O. And they started out developing autonomy kits that they would install on your tractor. So if you said, you know, I've got a 100 horse case tractor from 2007 and I want it to be automated in some respect, well, they had a kit and they could come out and put that on your tractor and it would essentially access the GPS to do this, you know, automatic guidance and automatic steering and all of that. And you could run it separately. Maybe you're driving another tractor in the field and you can keep an eye on it. More recently, I think in the last two or three years, they've moved into the space of turf grass growers. They have these very large turf grass farms that mow, you know, like every other day. I mean, mowers all the time. And of course, that's an ideal situation for automation of the system. And so they put in autonomy kits on these mowers for a number of large growers. And actually, I think some of those are in Georgia. And they have a team of engineers that I believe is sitting in Illinois or somewhere in the Midwest. And they're overseeing the actions of these systems. And they get error messages and they can shut something down or what have you, or they can send somebody out to check on a certain system. But that's really become the bread and butter of that company at present. That's I think, where most of their money is being made and where the development is taking place. One other thing you asked about where these technologies are coming to market. So I think everybody's familiar with drones and the fact that aerial drones have been commercially available, pretty cheap actually, for really high quality drones, depending on where you get them from, for a decade or so. So, you know, there are various issues with that. And one of those, as I mentioned, is where the drones come from. And there are concerns about cybersecurity with respect to drones. Very much drones have been available. I think the critical point is, what is the utility of autonomous drones in agriculture? And I think a lot of us had a lot of excitement, maybe starting around 2015, 16, when drones became available commercially, that, boy, think of all the things we can do with these on farm. And if you go talk to farmers, most of our interest as researchers was looking at remote sensing, and the farmers were thinking, well, that's cool. I can see a picture of my crop, right? But what do I do? And I asked a few of them, and you'd get some interesting answers. I had a former student when I used to teach at Texas A&M who was farming in the southern part of Texas. And I said, what are you doing with your drone? Because I knew he had one. He says, I use it when I'm irrigating. So I'll open up the valve on the irrigation system, and I'll fly my drone to the edge of the field. And I'll see when the water gets to the edge of the field, so I know when I can shut the valve off, right? So interesting, but probably a niche use and not something that's going to be commonly used. I think drones are probably about to take off with the introduction of spray drones, Some of that's been done in the last 2 or 3 years. The FAA has opened up some of the regulations associated with that. The drones are getting larger. In fact, here at the Agricultural Autonomy Institute, we've recently purchased 3 U.S. manufactured spray drones, and we have one that has an 18-gallon spray tank on it. It's about 400-pound takeoff weight. So very large, you know, in relative terms, very large drone for agriculture. And I really think that this is going to be where farmers start seeing the obvious utility in this.
Absolutely. That's really interesting. As you point out, the drones for sensing are something that in research we're very excited, and we use that a lot for different purposes. But for a grower, perhaps that's not going to be the easiest, or maybe even the one that gets them what they need in a timely manner, right? Awesome. All right. So, you know, we're talking a little bit here about terrestrial drone or terrestrial autonomous systems, a little bit about spray drones also to be used at the farm level. But something that perhaps is related to both of those categories that I want to follow up with you is, how do they fundamentally work? What is behind it that helps it to work in a way that is safe, that is efficient, and most importantly, or perhaps not most importantly, but also very important, profitable?
Yeah, good question. So if you just look at the fundamentals of autonomous systems, they really need 3 things to make them work. And one is some kind of sensing technology. And if you think about an autonomous tractor, it should have multiple sensing technologies. Obviously, it has to know where it is, so it has some kind of positioning sensing technology. That's probably GPS, and it's probably very high-precision GPS, like real-time kinematic RTK GPS. It may also have what's called an IMU, or an inertial measurement unit, as part of that navigation system. So, for example, if you happen to lose GPS for a moment, you've got this inertial measurement unit that can keep you on track and going for a period of time until your GPS is restored. So positioning sensing is really critical. Understanding your surroundings, perception is really critical, and that can be done in multiple ways. It can be done with cameras, multiple cameras that can provide 3D stereo imagery, or it can be done with LiDAR, which also produces 3-dimensional point clouds. That LiDAR is common on autonomous cars. You know, I think most people have heard something about Waymo, which is the original Google car, or Cruise. There are various, Uber was in this business for a while. Most of these cars actually use LiDAR to understand their surroundings. And so that's an option. But, you know, you think about, okay, what do we need to sense? We need to sense position on a tractor. We need to sense our surroundings, and we need to be able to understand if we're about to run into something we don't want to run into. That could be an object like a vehicle or a person or an animal or a row of plants that we don't want to run over. It could also be a hole or a ditch. And sometimes holes and ditches can be very difficult because, you know, it's not like an object. It's just a low spot and you don't know how deep it is, maybe. So there are lots of issues associated with that. But then once you get beyond just the navigational aspects of autonomous systems, there are things to consider, like, do we want to use an autonomous robot to harvest something? Or to do something else, there's a good bit of work going on at Washington State University where they're looking at pruning apple trees. Can you do that autonomously? Because it's extremely labor intensive, and you have to have people who are knowledgeable about exactly where to prune. So in that case, you've got to have sensors that are telling you, you know, here are all the branches on the plant. Which branches do I need to prune, and where do I need to cut them? So lots and lots of different sensing. So sensing is a big aspect of autonomous systems. The second aspect that I think is really critical is what I call the analytics. So sensors provide you data, and you have to analyze the data to produce a result that you can make a decision on. So I think of the analytical part as sort of the understanding the data and making decisions. These days, that's very commonly done with artificial intelligence because you're bringing in so much data from cameras. And AI is very well equipped to analyze that type of data and give you eventually decisions about, you know, turn left, turn right, slow down, speed up, cut here, don't cut here. Those kinds of decisions can be made. And then the third aspect of it is what I would call the actuation aspect. So once you've collected your data and you made a decision about what to do, how do you affect that decision? And that may be turning the wheels, it may be braking, it may be speeding up, slowing down. It may be, you know, implementing what we would call an end effector. And an end effector is essentially a gripper or some device at the end of a robotic arm that's doing something like cutting or grasping or what have you. And so how do you know where to move those things and to tell them when it's time to engage the crop, if you will?
That's a great explanation. I was just, you know, taking notes here, and I guess just to summarize, and perhaps you can add more if you wish, but basically these, I took a note here of four different components, right? So navigation is one of them. We have the sensing aspect, either be that to sense an obstacle or perhaps to sense a characteristic of the plant or maybe of the terrain that we want to be aware of and use for some purpose. We have that analytical component, which is taking all the sensing data and analyzing that, or maybe just making a prediction of what to do based on pre-trained models through AI. And then finally, we're navigating the field, we're sensing the plant in the field, we're making that sense information to make sense of that and through algorithms trained with AI. And then finally, whatever decision is made through that algorithm, actually having that actuation aspect to implement whatever decision was made, if some form of physical, aspect of that is required. Is that a good summary?
I think that's a good summary. I would probably say instead of there being four aspects of the system, there are three aspects. And so call it sensing and analytics and actuation. And those, all three of those can come together to allow for navigation or to allow for the use of a robotic arm with an end effector or to allow for those to be done together. You know, you might have a platform that has to navigate through the field and it has to decide where to stop and what to go around or whatever. And maybe it stops at a certain plant, and maybe on top of that platform is a robotic arm with a cutting device that is, you know, it's going out, reaching out to the plant and actually cutting it at certain places. So it's sort of sensing and analyzing and then actuating, and all those things can be done for navigation or for some more, you know, physical, call it manipulative task, if you will.
Awesome. So, okay. So let's say now that we're, you know, we have these autonomous systems, and maybe, you know, maybe a grower is listening to us and they're thinking, you know what, maybe I would like to invest on something like that, or maybe consider investing on something, on a technology like this. What would be the main benefits that a grower would have from making this type of investment that you foresee?
Well, you know, this is kind of typical in some respects, I guess, of precision agriculture. I mean, I started working in precision ag in 1997, and boy, we have developed some awesome technology over the years. But if I look back over the past almost 30 years now and look at which of those technologies are actually used on farm and marketed and people are, you know, have an obvious return on investment, it's a pretty small number of them. And so I think autonomous systems are the same way in some respects, that there will be certain aspects that growers will recognize as being profitable, you know, bringing good return on investment fairly early on, and those things will take over. And I think what we'll see in that regard is maybe not so much fully autonomous vehicles at the beginning. I think we'll probably see some more of these additional steps towards autonomy. You know, we've got the autonomous driving, automatic guidance, if you will, and that's been around for quite a while. And I think we'll see more of those kinds of things. I think one thing that's been worked on for quite a while is something called leader-follower technology. So if you have a combine that's harvesting, it has to be serviced by a tractor pulling a grain wagon, let's say. And you have to have a driver who's very careful to keep the grain wagon positioned in the right location. But what if you could have that tractor follow appropriately the combine and know when it's full and be able to drive away, and then you have another autonomous tractor coming in beside it? So I think some of the applications like that, I think, are going to be pretty obvious, obviously beneficial, because they reduce the requirement for labor when labor is really difficult to find. So this is not an autonomy example, but I think an example of technology development that really changed an industry, and it's in cotton. So cotton harvesting, you know, when I came into cotton, probably in the, I don't know, sometime in the 80s, they were just moving into what was called harvesting and putting in the modules. And they had these big rectangular metal boxes that they would dump the cotton from the harvester into these boxes and press it down with the ram and compact it. And then they would open up this box and move the box away and cover the module. Typically, if it's in a rainy area, they would cover it with a tarp and leave it there until they were ready to back a truck under this big thing and take it to the cotton gin. And that took several people. So you had to have a harvester driver. You had to have somebody driving a tractor with what was called a bull buggy. Essentially, it was like a grain wagon, but for cotton. And that person had to take that bull buggy over to the module builder, dump the bull buggy into the module builder, and you had to have at least one person operating the module builder. So very minimum, you had to have three people in that operation. Well, Deere and Case in the beginning, although Case isn't selling cotton harvesters at the moment, but they built these systems that actually built smaller modules on board the harvester, and it revolutionized the industry. I mean, now you have one driver that does all of those things, and you've got a package essentially sitting at the edge of the field that can be picked up and taken to the gin. And so when those were introduced, and particularly in Australia, where labor was really, really difficult to find, they just went from zero to about 95% adoption of that technology in about 5 years. And so I think that that kind of thing will be obvious when the technology gets to the point where it's really reliable, it's really safe. And I think, you know, leader follower technology is probably an area where we'll see that in the not too distant future. Another example would be, you know, you think about hay bales or other kinds of bales that you typically, you'll drive by a field after somebody's been in there, and there may be 1,500 bales spread out all over the field, and somebody's got to go out there with a tractor and pick these things up, right, and haul them over to the edge. What if you had an autonomous machine that would just do all that for you, right? There is a company, the name's not coming to me right off, but they've been working on that. If you go online and Google it, you can find some examples of it, but it's never been brought to market. You know, these things are very complicated to make work well and safe and reliably. That's one of the reasons we don't see very many autonomous cars on the market now. Back in 2015, people were talking about, yeah, we're going to have autonomous cars all over the road in 2020. Well, we're in 2025 now. We don't have very many of them, and it's because it's way more complicated than people realize.
Absolutely. That was fantastic. Thanks for sharing all those great applied examples. I think it really illustrated well some of the benefits and also where some of the technology is already present. And I mean, this example from Australia and the fast uptake of the technology is something I was not aware of. And it's just very, very interesting to see how if you have that huge need and you bring a technology that can fulfill that gap in a way that really helps growers to be more profitable, that adoption can be really fast. So thanks for sharing that example. All right, so I guess I have one more question for you here, which is one that I put together afterwards. Is the farm of the future going to be run by robots? And if you think so, how far away are we from that future?
That's a great question, and I think to an extent the answer is yes. I think we always want people involved, right, for various reasons. And they will need to be involved at various levels. But I think that we can have, for example, one farm manager overseeing multiple machines that are operating autonomously. When do I think that's going to happen? And so let me go back to the idea of the autonomous vehicles. There is a publication that's put out, an email newsletter that's put out called The Robot Report. And my memory is the fellow that founded that around 2015 called me. And he said, hey, I want to do an interview. I was like, great. Yeah, let's talk about this. I'm super excited. And he says, at the end of the conversation, we had this really good conversation. At the end, he says, so how long do you think it's going to be before robotic tractors are going to be really commonplace? And I said, 25 years. So we're going from 2015 to 2040-ish. We're 10 years down the road now. And I thought he was going to hang up on me because he just threw a total dead silence. I think he was, because back then everybody was talking about autonomous cars are going to be only 5 years. And I think maybe he was thinking 5 to 10, but we're at the 10 year point and we're barely scratching the surface right now. And so I think I would still stick with that, honestly. I would say by 2040, we're going to have a pretty good number of autonomous tractors being purchased and used on farms. I think we'll have what I call telematic systems on a lot of farms where growers can operate their machinery without having to physically be on them. And they'll be looking at maybe a screen that shows where they've got three different machines working at the same time, and they can control them in some safe way from a distance. So yeah, I would still go with that 15 years from now. That's my answer.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, we'll definitely be calling you 15 years from now to see what are your thoughts then.
Cool. That'll be good. I'll be much older. You know, I'll be old by then. That's all right.
All right. So, well, if you're listening to this episode and you're enjoying this conversation, you know, we invite you to drop a like, to subscribe to our channels, different channels and different social media platforms, and to really share this episode with anyone else that you think could benefit from this great conversation with Dr. Alex Thomason.
It's time for our famous three.
All right, so we're getting towards the end of our episode, which means that we have our last three questions that we ask every guest in this podcast. The first one is, what is your favorite technical resource that you have used, you think is something that makes a difference and that you would like to share with our audience?
Honestly, Leo, I wasn't very well prepared. I started looking around the room for books that I could pull out and show you, and I haven't found the ideal one, but I probably would say, I haven't looked at this in a while, but it was like the Physics and Chemistry Handbook. And I like that as a technical resource because it's got some of the most interesting data that you could ever find. And, you know, this isn't something that your average person or even your average farmer might want to know information from. But I found a lot of times, you know, if you need to know, for example, I was trying to do some calculations with cotton one time and I thought, man, I need to know a cotton fiber is what size is it? And how long is it? And what's the diameter? And by the way, it's made out of crystalline cellulose. And what's the density of crystalline cellulose? And I open this book up and it's got the density of crystalline cellulose in this book. So it's just got super unusual, interesting data in there. So I like to dig into that once in a while when I have a question.
Nice, nice. Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that. So our next question here is pretty much the same question, but outside of the technical arena. So would you have any resource that, you know, if used outside of engineering, agronomy, crop and soils that you would like to share with us?
So let me give you two answers real quick. And I was kind of prepared for this. And one is not completely outside of agronomy. So hopefully you can see this book that I'm holding up here.
Yes.
It's about Norman Borlaug, The Man Who Fed the World. I read this, finished reading it about a year ago. And Norman Borlaug was a pretty amazing guy. And if you're familiar with agronomy or agriculture, you've probably heard of him. And his name is associated with a lot of awards and other types of things. But he did some amazing things to really feed the world in India and other parts of Asia by doing breeding mainly of wheat. And so anyway, that's a great resource. And the other one that I want to show you, and this is much odder, and I had to print out the cover of this because I forgot to bring this book from my home to the office. But this is a book I read a few years ago, and it's not for the faint of heart. It's about 870 pages, if I remember right. So it took me a while to get through it. But it was essentially the author, Simon Sebag Montefiore, went to Moscow after the fall of the wall, and they opened up the archives in Moscow. And he spent 4 years there living in Moscow, poring over the archives just to learn about Stalin and write this book. It's absolutely amazing, mind-blowing, in kind of a negative way about what people can do to other people. And so it's not a light read, but it's really interesting and enlightening.
Perfect. All right. Well, thanks for sharing both of those resources. I am familiar with the first one. I'm not with the second one, and I'm, you know, excited to actually check it out and learn myself. All right, so our last question of the day is, what types of skills or skill set have you identified in successful professionals around you?
Probably the most important one is social skills, the ability to build relationships, to build trust in people. That's really interesting. I think a lot of times, you know, working as a university professor, you have students in class and you think, boy, that student's so sharp. They make 100 on everything. They've graduated with a 4.0 GPA. And sometimes those students are strong socially and sometimes they're not. Commonly what you see, if you look around the CEOs of some major corporations, maybe they got a, you know, bachelor's of business administration, and they had a 2.8 GPA, so they were okay students, but not too great, you know, and they probably had a really good social life in college, but they parlayed that social skill set into doing very well corporately. And, you know, honestly, I mean, a lot of it's just about being able to communicate with people, to be able to get along well with people, to build trust, to make wise decisions. And so I would just say that around the people that I've been around that have been most successful have had that skill set.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. And with that, we wrap up today's episode. Alex, it was awesome to have you here. I really appreciate all the great examples that you brought into the conversation. It was really easy for me, who, even though I work in precision ag, but not with robots. So that would be for my engineering colleagues like yourself. And it was really, really a pleasure to learn from you and through all the great examples. So thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Leo. Good to be with you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.